This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Boy, was I surprised when I found out that two people who I've interviewed, Mike White, who wrote the movie School of Rock, and his father Mel White, a Christian gay activist, were contestants on the reality show The Amazing Race.
Southern California, 0700 hours, the dawn of a new adventure. From this western coast of America, 11 teams will embark on a race around the world for $1 million.
So at each destination in this race around the world, the teams are required to perform physical feats ranging from paragliding to building a stone wall. The travel itself is an endurance test and a test of wits. So after Mike and Mel White were eliminated, we invited them to talk about their adventures and about their father-son relationship. As we'll hear later, when Mike was growing up, Mel attempted to overcome his homosexual feelings, trying every therapy available. And he also ghostwrote books by Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, and Billy Graham. Now Mel is a retired minister in the Metropolitan Community Church, which has a large gay congregation. And he's the co-founder of the gay activist group Soul Force. Mike White wrote the films Chuck and Buck, Orange County, School of Rock, and wrote and directed Year of the Dog. He was also a writer on the TV series Freaks and Geeks. Mel White, Mike White, welcome to Fresh Air. I still can't believe you did The Amazing Race. I mean, I have to say, of the reality shows, this one's kind of like, if the myth of Sisyphus was made into a reality show, this would be it, because you have to do these backbreaking things like carrying a traditional cheese rack up a slippery hill and then carrying 200 pounds of cheese wheels down the slippery hill. I know, like, on the first thing, the cheese wheel thing, Mel White, you said you had, like, a groin muscle injury. So what kind of injuries did you both sustain doing this?
Well, it happened before that, Dad. Tell him. I mean, he injured himself on the starting line.
They lined us up and said, ready, get, set, go. And I did what a young person does. I took a big stride, and I heard it pop. And so I limped all the rest of the way to our packs, got in the car, knew something was wrong, and really discovered how wrong it was on Cheese Hill.
Gosh, I would have just given up, honestly.
Oh, you can't give up.
Well, there's so much. You have no idea. You have to fill out so much paperwork. And there's so much of a buildup to actually leaving that by the time you're on the race, you don't want to go because it would be the ultimate anticlimax. So we were going to do everything we could just to stay in it as long as we could.
Yeah, what kind of paperwork do you have to fill out? I'm thinking, like, there must be so many. Go ahead.
They tested us psychologically and physically, and I flunked the MMPI.
That's the personality index test?
Right. Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, and the psychiatrist came in, and Michael was trying to stifle laughter, and she said, "You are the highest on the paranoia scale we've ever had."
Well, boy, you have reason to score high on the paranoia scale. I mean, you have to travel with bodyguards sometimes because you go to Christian churches, to fundamentalist churches and universities, and try to convince them that they should accept homosexuality as a normal part of life and stop working against it. So you have reason to be paranoid.
Well, that's why when the psychiatrist started going through the questions and I started answering them, I knew that test was not for an activist.
Really? Well, in some ways, reality shows are designed to bring out the worst in people because you have to be brutally competitive, incredibly aggressive, and honest in the cruelest sense. Like, people are often encouraged to really say what they're feeling and not put any kind of politeness around it, which ends up sounding just like cruelty. So did you ever feel like you risked falling into that kind of behavior?
Michael said from the beginning, Dad, we're going to do this for fun, and I don't want you to go aggro on me. I had to look it up. Aggravated, don't get aggravated. And now and then he'd have to remind me that we're in it for the fun of it, but we never came close to having a fight. It was just too much fun to fight.
One of the things that surprised me watching you, Mike, was that, like in movies, and this first time I saw you in a film was in your movie Chuck and Buck, in which you're this kind of obsessive, like, nerdy, backwards character who's never really emotionally grown up. And you know, the characters that you play are usually not exactly known for their, like, strength and physical prowess. But, like, you know, you take off your shirt in this, you got real muscles. Like, you are really physically fit, you know?
I told you, Michael.
I wasn't expecting that.
He ran, you know, in his underwear.
I never thought I'd get a compliment on my musculature from Terry Gross.
That's right. And as your father just pointed out, you had to, like, run in your underwear for one of these, of the series.
I think, yeah.
With heavy boots on, I might add.
Yeah. I don't know what to say. I'm just blushing. I have no comment. I have no response.
and
well,
Mel,
go ahead and blush.
Well, Mel, I'm wondering what it was like for you. I mean, like, you are 68. You're probably among the oldest contestants that they've had on. And to go through this incredibly physical experience, it's strenuous for the most physically fit person, for the youngest most physically fit person. Were there parts where you thought, like, no, maybe this wasn't the smartest idea?
No, I'm waiting for you to say something about my musculature.
Well, you look very fit.
You did great, Dad. You did great.
Yeah, I got a muscle somewhere. I just haven't seen it lately. No, I never felt really to the place we would give up. But when we were considering being eliminated on that last rung, I had to remind Michael to look sad.
So what was it like to watch yourselves do all the, physical feats that you had to do, paragliding?
Terrible.
And, yeah.
Terrible. Terrible. I didn't know my wrinkles had wrinklets flopping in the breeze. I mean, I look as old as, you know, as Satan. God, I was just so depressed after I saw the first one. I'm not that old. There's some way they fixed that up on the camera. They've got wrinkle added or something. But
yeah,
first,
I'm not
I got
that
used
pale.
To it. And you're not that pale, that's right. Not that muscular either.
Oh, Dad. But no, it would. I mean, it's. I would get stressed before every episode. Just you know, because you don't know what they're gonna. You see it the same time America sees it. So I'm not used to that. And you know, you become self-conscious. It's like that part of it was not the appeal for me. I as much as I guess I've chosen an exhibitionist line of work, and to go on a reality show, you've got to be some sort of exhibitionist to want to do it. But that part of it is really not the pleasure. The pleasures were actually the doing of it, and then the unfolding of the show was kind of met with a little bit of dread for me.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Mike White and Mel White, and they were just father-son contestants on the reality show The Amazing Race. And they both have really interesting backgrounds. Mike is a screenwriter and director. He wrote the screenplays for School of Rock, Orange County, The Good Girl, Chuck and Buck, and he wrote and directed Year of the Dog. He's also appeared in a bunch of things, including a starring role on Chuck and Buck. Mel White is a gay activist, co-founder of the gay rights group Soul Force. He's a minister in the Metropolitan Community Church, which ministers to lesbian, bisexual, gay, and transgendered people. But before he came out, he was, you know, a Christian evangelical who was very close to a lot of the leadership, and he ghost wrote books for Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, and Billy Graham. Now, I have interviewed you both separately, but never together. So there's so much I want to talk to you both about being, you know, a family. Mel White, let me start with a question for you. Now, you were closeted when you wrote the books for Falwell, Robertson, and Graham. And, you know, earlier in your life, you had tried therapies to overcome your homosexuality, including shock treatment and exorcism. Just to give us a sense of what you had to go through before just accepting the fact that you were gay, what was the exorcism like?
There was a Protestant charismatic group that just put their hands on me and prayed and prayed and prayed until I about went to sleep, hoping that the demon of homosexuality would be exorcised. But I went to a Catholic monastery that was known for its exorcisms, and when the abbot said, What demon do you want to have exorcised? I said, homosexuality. And after a long pause, he said, we can't help you here. I've always been grateful for that kind of honesty.
What was that supposed to mean, do you think?
Well,
from their point of view?
Yeah, it just meant that, you know, without gays, there wouldn't be a Catholic Church. I mean, cardinals, bishops, priests, and they know that gay men have served the church faithfully and with integrity for centuries. And I think they don't want to toss out that demon because that demon works for the church.
Maybe that's what they meant. Maybe they meant that it just hasn't, exorcisms haven't worked in this area.
Yeah. Anyway, it was really interesting to go through this. The first problem for me was not recognizing there was such a thing as gay or homosexual. For me, I was brought up thinking that that's both a sickness and a sin, sickness that needs to be cured and a sin that needs to be forgiven. So I said to Lila right at the beginning of our relationship,
this is your wife.
I said, you know, I'm struggling with same-sex attraction. And she simply said, well, what do you want to do about it? And I said, I want to be married. I want to have children. I want to have grandkids. I don't want to eat quiche. You know, the whole thing of what it means to be a man these days. And she said, well, then let's work on it. And so for the next 20 years, literally, we went to counselor after counselor, spent probably at least $100,000 on Christian counselors who said, if you'll just take more showers, colder showers, if you'll just pray more, if you'll just learn more Bible verses, that will take it away. And of course, that proved to be folly.
Including shock therapy.
Yeah, that was interesting. It wasn't the serious kind of shock therapy that they take you into a room and they fixed all these electrodes onto me and then showed me pictures of men and women. And when I saw a picture of a woman, I could turn off the power myself. And when I saw a picture of a man that was attracting me, I had to turn up the power. So it was I handling all of those choices. And of course, I wanted desperately to not have this feeling anymore. So I put my hair stand on end for a couple times there.
My guests are Christian gay activist Mel White and his son, screenwriter, director, and actor Mike White. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are father and son, Mel and Mike White. They were a team on the CBS reality series, The Amazing Race, and were eliminated 2 Sundays ago. Mike wrote the movies School of Rock, Chuck and Buck, and Year of the Dog. His father, Mel, is a Christian gay activist. Before coming out, he ghostwrote books for several famous Christian leaders. Mike, I assume this is when you were growing up, that your father was ghostwriting books for Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, Billy Graham. Were they held up as ideals to you, people to be emulated and followed?
Not really. I grew up going to a secular private school. It was I did not go to religious schools growing up, and had a lot of friends that were outside of the church and outside of that. And my parents, while my dad, you know, came from a very evangelical background, that was not the vibe around my house. I mean, had a lot of theological discussions over dinner, and those were real and influenced me. But at the same time, it didn't have that kind of sort of fire and brimstone vibe over at our house. It was, my dad was, and my mom are both kind of open-minded and inclusive. And so some of the more kind of darker aspects to kind of that world, I don't think were really present in our household.
Mel White, how come you sent Mike to a secular school and not a Christian school?
One thing, it's kind of hard for me to clear up something, but my agent was Swifty Lazar, and he sold me to Simon Schuster to write these guys' biographies. And so many people picture me sitting at their table creating all of their anti-gay policies and so forth, whereas I just flew in, stayed time with them, recorded these interviews, and then wrote these biographies. So I would take home a lot of disgust. I mean, you know, when you get up close to Jerry Falwell, you can't help but like him, but you can't help but be disgusted by so many things he's saying. And I think the kids heard a lot of my reaction to these guys that would not set them up as models at all.
You know, but it's interesting, even when you came out and really were openly angry with and critical about the leaders, the Christian evangelical leaders, you retained your faith and you became a minister in the Metropolitan Community Church, which is, basically a gay church. So you never lost your faith, even though your life was no longer compatible with the faith.
You know, I distinguish.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. I distinguish between spirituality and religion, and I really gave up on religion and can hardly go to any of their churches or watch any of their programs. Fortunately, I go to First Christian in Lynchburg that's totally accepting. We had our first lesbian wedding there last week. So, I was really afraid that my kids would become like I was in terms of feeling ought about religion. But at the same time, it was my faith that got me through this. They taught me about a Jesus who loves anybody all the time, and I really believed in that, and that God had a smiling face to me most of the time. And so I don't know how I would have made it through all this struggle without thinking he, God, she still believes in me and still has work for me to do and is forgiving me even when I screw up. So I think my feelings about Jesus and God were the most important feelings I had to help me survive those days.
So you said you gave up on organized religion, but you're kind of back in the game. I mean, you're a minister now. You have a church. It's just a different kind.
Yeah, I'm not pastoring now. I'm retired, and I work full-time with Soul Force trying to help churches overcome their misinformation. Religion-based oppression is the problem for gay and lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people. It's religion that keeps homophobia alive, and so I'm still angry. It's very hard for me to participate in Soul Force actions now because we are committed to nonviolence. And there are moments that I would really, I get so angry that there's not a nonviolent streak in me at that moment. So I have to watch it. I'm really angry. I've received over 100,000 letters, Terry, after Stranger at the Gate. They're stored in huge crates.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, they're stored in huge crates. And invariably, these young people are asking me, how can you be sure that God loves you if you're gay? You know, the question that the church should have answered a long time ago, the church has not answered. The church has said God doesn't love you as you are. And so you cannot know how many people I've seen suffer, how many kids I've buried who have killed themselves, how many kids I've visited in hospitals who tried to kill themselves. And it's all because the church has gotten this all wrong. And so, yeah, my anger is bubbling just below the surface right now.
Mike, can I ask you, when your father came out and, you know, made peace with the fact that he was gay and then even became a gay activist, did that have like a liberating effect on you to see like your father freed from the suffering that he experienced for so many years?
Definitely, I've felt that he was happier once he was able to be open and honest with everyone in his life about who he was, and at the same time, I you know, like you just were listening to him, he's still in the fight, you know, and he's not hiding anymore, but I think that he's committed to helping others that were in the same position that he was in, which is admirable. And at the same time, it's definitely taken a toll on him. It's not, you know, like he said at the beginning of the interview, you know, he failed his psychological test and they were questioning whether to let him go on The Amazing Race. And when you think of the people that go on these reality shows, like the fact that, you know, that my dad was on the border of whether they felt like it was appropriate for him to come, it's clear that, like, you know, always being in the front lines of this, you know, fight has had a huge impact on his psyche. And I think that, you know, one of the great unexpected fallouts of being on The Race is that he's getting so much feedback now for being, you know, for people seeing him as this, you know, compassionate and kind, funny guy that he is and proud father that he also is. And I think, you know, it's one of the first times in his life that I can recall where he isn't a divisive figure. Everybody just likes him, and they you know, he comes off sweet, and I think that's going to be a healing thing for him in a funny, unexpected way.
Mike, you said that your father's like still in the fight, and I'm wondering, like, do you feel in the fight at all? You've described yourself in publications. I've read that you were gay. I've read that you were bisexual. I'm not really sure how you describe yourself, but either way, there'd be reason to become an activist if you were so inclined. But it sounds like you don't see yourself as being in the fight, per se.
Well, I think that in in the world that I live, you know, I inhabit my chosen profession, there's ways that you, through representation and the kinds of stories you tell, that you, you know, try to make your own sense of what, you know, this is meaningful and this might affect change in some way and people's perceptions. And for me, that's where I've put my energy, is certainly from a professional point of view. And at the same time, no, I don't consider myself an activist in the way that my dad is. But you know, life is long. Who knows what's in store?
And you're not a churchgoer, right?
No, I'm not a churchgoer.
Mike and Mel White will be back in the second half of the show. You may have seen them together on the CBS reality series The Amazing Race. They were eliminated 2 Sundays ago. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Mike White and his father, Mel White. You may have seen them work as a team on the CBS reality series The Amazing Race. They were eliminated 2 Sundays ago. Mike White wrote the movies School of Rock, Chuck and Buck, Orange County, and Year of the Dog, and he wrote for the TV series Freaks and Geeks. His father, Mel, is a Christian gay activist and co-founder of Soul Force. Before he came out, when he was married and trying to overcome his homosexual feelings, he ghost-wrote books for Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, and Billy Graham. Mel White, several of the evangelical leaders who you knew or have worked with have passed on. Jerry Falwell, D. James Kennedy.
Francis Schaeffer,
yeah, Tammy Faye Baker. So as the old leadership has left or is leaving the stage, there's new leadership coming up, probably most famous, Rick Warren. Do you see the new leadership changing things in terms of the evangelical community's leadership's position on homosexuality?
No, I don't. These new megachurch leaders, they have a kind of a patina of cordiality. They love you, but then they want you to change. So they're not like Jerry. You always knew where Jerry was, like a rattlesnake. But these guys are without rattles, but they're still snakes.
Now, Richard Cizik, who was the chief lobbyist for the National Association of Evangelicals, he was fired from that position after saying on our show that he supported civil unions. And I'm wondering, you know, I figured you were following that story. I wonder what your observations about that was.
That, you know, he was a very able guy, and he was fired because he said what he said, which I think supports what I'm saying, that basically the old guard dead has left a new guard in its place, and homosexuality is the only issue they can't deal with. The pastors say the people aren't ready. The people say the pastor isn't ready. Nobody's ready. And so kids by the millions keep falling through the holes. So, yeah, I don't have any respect for most of the megachurch leaders in terms of the stand they've taken. They'll work with people with AIDS in Namibia, but they won't let people with AIDS into their congregation. I mean, or work with those who have AIDS in their congregation. So, yeah, I'm very pessimistic, paranoid.
Mel, my understanding is that you moved to Lynchburg, Virginia, in part to be close to Jerry Falwell and to protest his church and to always try to goad him into changing and recognizing homosexuality as something that wasn't evil and that didn't need to be changed and to just accept it. When he died, what was your reaction to his death? I mean, you were almost... You were almost like a duo in that sense, like you'd been through so many sparring matches together.
Yeah. Gary and I, my partner Gary Nixon, I moved into a little apartment right across the street from his church, and then we'd invite people into our house after church and have cookies and so forth. And then we'd go into the church, and when he'd talk about gay people, we'd stand up and protest. He got so used to us standing up and protest, we became part of the liturgy. So, you know, it wasn't much of a protest. But we found in Lynchburg, which is, you know, a southern city, we found the kind of acceptance opening up little by little by little. And we are so pleased with what's happening in the churches of Lynchburg and the people of Lynchburg. So for me, yeah, we miss when Jerry died. What one regret I had is that he didn't have a chance to apologize for all the lies and the half-truth and the hyperboles he had used against us. But I had to say there's a lot of people who will miss him because he was a good pastor and he was a good provost, and his university is going strong and his church is going strong today.
Mike White, I have some questions for you. You're one of our many guests who has worked on Freaks and Geeks, the now cult status short-lived TV series set in high school. Now, because you got started on Freaks and Geeks early in your career, you met Seth Rogen, Judd Apatow, Jason Segel. And a while ago in New York Magazine, you had an interesting comment about Knocked Up, which starred Seth Rogen and was directed by Judd Apatow. And can I just quote that and get your reaction to this? You write, "To me, I definitely stand on the corner of wanting to give voice to the people who are bullied and not the bully. And here's where comedy is catharsis for people who are picked on. There's a strain in Knocked Up where you sort of feel like something's changed a little bit. My sense of it is that because these guys are idiosyncratic looking, their perception is that they're still the underdogs. But there's something about the spirit of the thing that comes under the guise of comedy where it's weird. At some point, it starts feeling like comedy of the bullies rather than the bullied." And do you think that's a strain that's classically run through a lot of teen and young adult films, and maybe even more so now? That,
yeah, I mean, to me, I mean, I got into some, you know, there were a lot of like follow up conversations with Judd and those guys after that article ran, you know, I really respect Judd, and a lot of those movies are funny to me. But I also, you know, what I was trying to say was that, you know, you feel like, you know, some of it is about the comedy of people whose, you know, their scope of interest really ends in their like pleasure palace of, you know, video games and you know, genre movies and you know, it's like. So some of it you feel like it's like, I don't know, I guess I still feel a version of what I said, but that's not, you know, obviously there's a lot of more to it than that, and there's a lot more that I like about those movies and stuff, but yeah, I don't know. I don't want to get into trouble.
It sounds like you're backing off, Mike.
I'm just, you know, it's like, for me, it was like, it was definitely bad form for me to say something negative about a friend's movie, you know, a week before it came out. And had I been on the receiving end of that, I would have been as irritated as I'm sure Judd was. But I, you know, to me, it was more trying to talk about the strain of, you know, the kind of trend of comedy of late, which is, you know, where, you know, you feel like only certain kinds of characters populate those movies. And that part of it, I think, is, you know, something worth talking about, you know, and it's not a judgment necessarily, as just something to observe. And I think that, you know, it's one thing when the characters like in Freaks and Geeks are 12 years old and they're, you know, being bullied on the playground. But when the characters are now in their 20s and 30s, and the psychology of it is still sort of in that same kind of, I don't know, it's the same kind of identities that you just wonder, you know, at what point do you get over, you know, being rejected by the hot girl when you're in junior high, and now it's time to, you know, to look beyond the sort of that kind of romantic storyline, I guess. I don't know. It's hard to explain. But it's you know, it's an interesting thing that those movies are really resonating right now with America, and they're funny, which is obviously the reason why they're successful. But I feel like there's someone else smarter than me should do sort of, you know, an inquiry into what the catharsis is for the viewer to see these movies about these particular characters.
After having been on The Amazing Race, do you feel like you have a deeper understanding of why reality shows are so popular?
Well, I've always loved reality shows. I mean, certain ones, and I think that you know, just being on The Amazing Race has made me even more of a believer that real life lessons can be derived from reality shows. That there's some real truths to some of the lessons learned on reality shows. So, and I think that's part of why people tune in. It's not just for the humiliation or the ridiculousness or just, you know, people embarrassing themselves. It's that there's actual things that are sustaining and interesting, and that people that then kind of apply to their own personalities or their own lives.
I went thinking that most people go to reality shows like people go to attend racetracks because they like to see the wrecks. And I thought that if you're not nasty, you're not going to be popular on a reality show. And yet the kind of feedback we're getting and that CBS is getting about Mike and me, that we were having such a good time and it was such a relief from all the fighting. So I'm kind of changed about that. I think maybe you could be very popular on a reality show by just being nice.
Well, thanks to both of you so much for talking about your lives and your experiences on The Amazing Race. It was really fun to watch you both on that. Fun and surprising to see you there. So good luck with the work that you do. And thank you so much for talking together with us. Thank you.
Awesome.
Thanks,
thank
Terry.
Mike White wrote the movies School of Rock, Orange County, Chuck and Buck, and Year of the Dog. His father, Mel White, co-founded Soul Force, whose goal is freedom from religious and political oppression for gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people.